From WYPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. This week, we're taking a look back at the presidency of Barack Obama. My guest today is Michael Eric Dyson, a searing provocateur whose unstinting critique of the historic nature of Obama's tenure includes what he considers missed opportunities to advance the cause of racial equality. One of Dyson's chief criticisms is the president's reluctance to hold white people at least partially responsible for black suffering. In his latest book, Dyson argues that the responsibility lies not just with uninformed bigots, but with people who may consider themselves enlightened and fair-minded, but who can't accept the truth of racial history. The book is called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Today on Midday, Michael Eric Dyson is fixing to preach. Are you part of the choir? First, the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. This week, we are assessing the legacy of President Barack Obama. His term in office comes to an end in 48 hours. What won't end for the foreseeable future is a conversation about Mr. Obama's effectiveness as a leader. And that conversation will always be tied in some way to the conversation about race in America. Like the catchphrase of celebrating diversity, it has become widely accepted by white people and people of color that in order to address the longstanding problem of racial inequality, we need to have a conversation about race that is somehow better, deeper, and more candid than the ones we are used to having. We hear, and I think it's true, that the only good conversations about race are those that are uncomfortable, those that avoid bromides that have people talking past each other in favor of talking in a way that leads to greater understanding and empathy. My guest today has, in my view, done much to advance the conversation about race. Dr. Michael Eric Dyson is a ubiquitous presence in the media discussing the thorny and complex issues surrounding race and culture. He is the author of 19 books, including a frank and not always admiring account of the Obama years called The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America. Our focus today, however, will be on his latest book, which was published yesterday. It is a powerful, personal, and compelling piece of work. It's organized in the form of a worship service. Dr. Dyson is one of America's most provocative public intellectuals, an acclaimed scholar who teaches sociology at Georgetown University. He is also an ordained Baptist minister, and his new book is an extended peroration on the subject of race and what we can do to confront bigotry and the history of racial injustice that dates back to the founding of our republic. It's called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Michael Eric Dyson joins me on the line from the studios of WNYC in New York. Dr. Dyson, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, my friend, for having me.
So this book is organized around a worship service, as I mentioned. You've got the call to worship, an invocation, a benediction. And the central part of it is a two-part sermon. The first part is called Repenting of Whiteness. The second part is called Being Black in America. And you make the point that white people need to make a conscious effort to change and to stop being white. So tell us, what does giving up whiteness look like?
Well, it means giving up a certain kind of innate or inherent sense of privilege, an intrinsic superiority that has been tutored and taught throughout the ages. It means relinquishing a narrow and artificial conception of superiority and privilege, and then revoking that in deference to a broader sense of humanity. So when I ask white brothers and sisters to give up whiteness, I'm not asking them not to be themselves or not to be their best selves and not to be human. I'm asking them to be more human. I'm asking them to be more of themselves. And I think whiteness intervenes in a destructive fashion on the natural evolution of consciousness among many white brothers and sisters, and I think that we have to be conscious of that. And many white people resent even being called white people. You know, the things that black people and brown people and other people of color have to deal with every day, Asian and Latino, what we have to deal with every day, being called a group, being seen as a collective, not being granted our individuality and the like, is rather opprobrious to many white brothers and sisters who see it as a vicious assault upon them or one that is unfair and unjust. And I think that when we make the discomfort in that whiteness more palpable, many white brothers and sisters can begin at least to grapple with what it means to be a person who has a race, like men who are taught that they have a gender too. White people have a race too, and that whiteness is one among many other racial and ethnic identities in the family of race and ethnicity. And when they're taught to think about it that way, then they can come to grips with it. They can see how artificial it is, how it's been constructed over space and time, that there are options that they can access, and there are ways in which they can put away the more, I think, problematic features of that whiteness and embrace a broader sense of humanity.
You talk about, in your critique of whiteness, as it being an impediment even to the capacity to be empathetic. You say that it's hard to be white and empathetic to others. It's hard to give up this willful ignorance. It's a drug, it's a privilege and addiction. Your whiteness is a shield that keeps you from knowing what black folk must always know. And then a little later, you suggest that white folk want to be treated with kid gloves or like adolescents who can't take the truth of grown-up racial history. So does that racial history include the difficulty of being white and being empathetic? What is the connection between whiteness and a paucity of empathy?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think there is a kind of organic relationship between this paucity of empathy, this lack of inclination to understand the other. You know, many white brothers and sisters don't want to be even minimally challenged. This is what Barack Obama understood in the White House as the occupant of the Oval Office, that it's easier to beat up on black people, to challenge black people, to ask them to think more critically and to interrogate their privileges, their burdens, their perspectives, than it is to ask white people to do that. Why do we know that? Because he didn't ask white people to do it. He asked black people to do it. Even in his parting speech, his farewell speech, he said, be empathetic toward the white guy who, you know, that you on the outside looks as if he possesses more advantages than he does. But he didn't say, hey, white guys, those of you who think that you are underprivileged, imagine what it might mean to black and brown and red and yellow people who have barriers that have been historically imposed, who don't even have the minimum of what you have, because that's not how it goes. There's a false equivalency established by Barack Obama, and there's a false and there's a logic from which that false equivalency draws. And that is that it's very difficult to ask white people to think about whatever privileges they have, because many white people want to say, look, I'm not rich. A lot of black people make more money than me. And you say a couple things immediately. First of all, the rich black people during segregation and Jim Crow didn't get exceptions to the treatment of the masses of black people. Your money couldn't buy your way out of Jim Crow, number one. And number two, if you walk down the street and the police stops you and then you live in that encounter, that's the greatest white privilege one might imagine that many people of color would covet. So when I think of the lack of empathy, it's the way in which white people have not been taught to think critically about their racial formation in America and how that whiteness has served them, and not only served them, but precluded their participation in the drama and pageantry of American citizenship in a way that black people have had to. In other words, black people have had to struggle for any sense of legitimacy in a way that many white people don't understand. For instance, Donald Trump spent 2 years of his life casting aspersions on President Barack Obama, seeing him through the birther movement as an illegitimate president. And the moment an icon of the civil rights movement and a great politician like John Lewis suggests that Mr. Trump is not legitimate, he goes haywire. He goes ham. That is whiteness in précis. That is whiteness in a thumb, if you will, in a nutshell. That is the way in which a kind of vitriolic and invidious resistance to being aware of who you are as a white person and how that whiteness has operated historically and what advantages you've been able to accumulate, and to think about the resentment you have. Black people are taking over. They're getting all the advantages. How many black presidents have there been? How many black senators have there been? How many black congresspeople have there been? How many heads of Fortune CEO companies have there been? In other words, when you look at every major index of success, thriving, and flourishing in America, people of color lag far behind, even women for that matter. So there's an exaggeration in whiteness and a paucity of empathy, and that has been generated out of the logic of maintaining and preserving a certain kind of innocence that refuses to come to grips with the bad things and the horrible consequences of whiteness in America.
Dr. Michael Eric Dyson is my guest for the hour here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. His new book is called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Dr. Dyson, here's a little clip from the president's farewell speech in which he talks about the things you just alluded to.
For blacks and other minority groups, that means tying our own very real struggles for justice to the challenges that a lot of people in this country face. Not only the refugee or the immigrant or the rural poor or the transgender American, but also the middle-aged white guy who, from the outside, may seem like he's got advantages, but has seen his world upended by economic and cultural and technological change. We have to pay attention and listen.
So, Dr. Dyson, you wrote an essay about Trump and his ignorance of black people in the Times, the New York Times, a week or so ago. And you mentioned the white elites who invoke working class solidarity to try to sort of get past the intrinsic systemic racism that exists in our country. But in your book, you do talk a little bit about the equivalence between race and class inequality. You mentioned gender oppression, homophobia. This is a complicated issue. I mean, is making an equivalence between prejudice and bigotry towards African Americans equivalent to making that equivalent to race and class or to class inequality? Is that kind of taking our eye off the ball?
I think so to a certain degree. Look, the white working class must be paid attention to, but they must be paid attention to because they're part of a broader collection of working class peoples that most people don't speak about. Notice we didn't say this is the revenge, this election is the revenge of black working class or brown working class or yellow or red working class.
Oh, yeah, it was very specific, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was very specific in the name of getting beyond identity politics. Now, Brother Tom, isn't that interesting that in the name of eviscerating the vicious legacy of identity politics, we appeal to it even more strictly and more astringently? So I think that what's interesting is that the white working class has been used as a kind of terminological propriety among richer and wealthier white people to act as if they are in cahoots with and in league with those working class people, but they don't really give a darn about them. As Michael Jackson would say, they don't really care about us. And then beyond that, they are used, empathy with the white working class by richer white people to avoid policies that would help working class white people as well as working class black and brown and other poor people. So it is very interesting how that has gone on afoot. And on beyond that, W.E.B. Du Bois said one of the things that white people have been sold and given is the psychic wages of whiteness. That working class white people have been told, yeah, you may not have a bunch of money, but at least you're not black, and at least you're not that inferior figure. And so many white working class people have bought into the lie of black inferiority as a compensatory mechanism for their collective egos while shielding themselves from the reality that if we got into league with black and brown and red and yellow working class people, we'd have a far stronger union, both symbolically and literally, and we could argue for and leverage the authority of our collective power in a far more effective fashion. But racism stops working class white people from understanding their plight and predicament in league with working class black and brown and red and yellow people. And I think so. If we're going to talk about the working class, let's do so. This is why I, for instance, had a problem with Bernie Sanders and many of these other white brothers and sisters after the election. Oh, yes, the lesson we learned from this election is that we ignored the white working class. Bernie Sanders, interestingly enough, like Donald Trump, avoided some of the issues of race in deference to class. Bernie Sanders, I think, said that it's easier to deal with racism and to a degree sexism than it is to deal with the fact that, you know, Goldman Sachs is a problem to America. In what America, Mr. Sanders, Senator Sanders, are you operating where it's easier to call that out than it is to call out racism and sexism and misogyny? This, to me, indicates the blindness of a Bernie Sanders. And it's easier to scapegoat the so-called ostensible bigotry of a figure like Donald Trump than it is to call Bernie Sanders to account for his own legacy of racial blindness. And this is what I'm after in this book. Let's not just do the easy stuff of beating up on the Donald Trump people, though, you know, Donald Trump is an easy enough target who should be who should fall within our own purview. But it's more difficult to be honest about the way in which Bernie Sanders has participated in a problematic conception of race as well, trying to get rid of race in deference to a notion of class, and doesn't understand that race makes class hurt more and class complicates the issue of race.
It's midday on WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. It's our honor to spend the hour with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson. His new book is called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. We'll have more with Dr. Dyson, and we'll take your calls, comments, and questions when we come back from a little break. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall, our email address, midday@WIPR.org, and our phone number, 410-662-8780. Stay with us.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the bass down. Skimming, now let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in the twilight. We're pretty Benjamin is the highlight. Now tell my mama I love her, but this what I like. Lord knows, 20 of them in my Chevy. Tell them all to come and get me, reaping everything I sow. So my karma come in heaven, no preliminary hearings on my record. I'm a gangsta in silence for the record. Tell the world I knew.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the program tomorrow, we'll finish our series of conversations exploring the Obama legacy with Liz Copeland, the founder of the Urban Conservative Project, and Philadelphia Daily News editor Michael Days, whose new book examines what President Obama has accomplished. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will have her weekly theater review. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Dr. Michael Eric Dyson. He's a professor of sociology at Georgetown University. His latest book is called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Dr. Dyson, we have a email from Don in Bel Air, Maryland. He says, as a middle-aged white guy, I've come to think of this election as a massive tantrum by Midwestern white people who see their influence slipping away as the country gets browner. This will probably be the last time these people have this much power over a national election, since demographics is destiny. And in your book, you talk about the cowardice of white people who know what's true but don't speak out. I mentioned this to our mutual friend Taylor Branch yesterday, and he reminded me that that point is redolent of Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail. And you talk about the smug dismissal of unenlightened and bigoted whites as poor white trash. And then you say, as if you can really separate yourselves from them. So to quote a famous black president, I think there are a lot of folks who would say, yes, we can. Don is doing that very thing. What is the connection between sort of out-and-out bigots and those folks in the white community who do think of themselves as fair-minded folks?
Yes, that's a great point. And it's a beautiful summary that you offered there in thumbnail sketch and a brief abbreviated genealogy. I think Don is right on it. And I called for it, and he delivered it, so to speak. And it is important to do so. It's important for white allies to show up and speak up and tell the truth of what we all know, so that black and brown and red and yellow people and other people of color don't look crazy, don't look illogical, don't look insane or irrational. And there is a relationship. This is why I tried to draw the relationship between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. They are closer than people think, though far apart on so many other issues. I'm not trying to reduce Bernie Sanders to Donald Trump. God knows that. But what I'm trying to suggest, that same kind of white male blindness of a certain age group. They're both in their early 70s. Mr. Sanders a bit older. And they have been accustomed to thinking about these issues in a particular fashion. Bernie Sanders, of course, was challenged by Black Lives Matter, was cantankerous in his response, as an older person would be. And the older I get that. But at the same time, there is a kind of blindness and resistance and the feel a kind of racial superiority. Hey, we're better. We're better as liberals. We're better as people who are progressive. Now, I think that progressive and liberal people have been least racist in their own behavior, deportment, and, you know, in their comportment and in how they view the world. But at the same time, there are blindnesses. Martin Luther King Jr. at the end of his life said, I'm afraid to admit and to acknowledge, but most Americans are unconscious racists. That's not what we hear during the King celebration. So there is an organic relationship between, in one of evolution, in a Darwinian or maybe an Alfred Wallace sense, of the relationship between the early inchoate fashions of bigotry under, say, a Jim Crow worldview and the more polite and refined forms of, I think, racial intolerance and whiteness that happen when white liberals go, they get resentful. Why would you dare put me in league with them? Why would you challenge what I'm doing? I'm your ally. I'm trying to be on your side. Why are you challenging me? There's a kind of discomfort that is also the assertion of a certain kind of power and privilege. And we've got to interrogate those and ask questions of those things. And they're not easy to do, especially when those people who we call to account have been allies in the past. But there is a necessity to try to engage them, nevertheless, in a far more, I think, vigorous manner. And Donald Trump is the ultimate example of a toddler presidency. We want to talk about not growing up. When Don made the statement about the kind of, you can probably repeat it, what he said about, he didn't say toddler, but he said, you know, the refusal to grow up, a kind of infantile reaction to losing power. Donald Trump is the ultimate face of that inclination. Donald Trump is the face of a toddler presidency, a white toddler presidency, the refusal to cooperate, to be in your terrible twos, to say everything that's on your mind, to scream and to holler and to demand that the world revolve around oneself. His tweets are expurgation, you know, are explosions of, you know, of nastiness and viciousness and intolerance and spoiledness. Can we just call it that? And I think as a result, there has been a step back in terms of our racial progress because he has emboldened a certain kind of whiteness that is defensive, that wants to refuse to interrogate its own privileges and think about its own practices, and a whiteness that will not be called to account. And in fact, a whiteness that will castigate the so-called political correctness across the aisle and say, no, we're not going to be politically correct anymore. Well, the people who are most intolerant of politically incorrect speech are those who claim that political correctness has gone amok. Many white brothers and sisters will not, cannot hear the truth from many people of color who routinely, and I don't know if I'm breaking a secret to many white people, black people, brown people, red people, yellow people, hold back routinely. They look at your feelings and don't want to hurt you because you couldn't handle the truth. It's a Jack Nicholson moment interacting with Tom Cruise on A Few Good Men. Truth? You can't handle the truth. It's a Jack Nicholson phenomenology and epistemology going on there. That is a way of being and a way of knowing. And so I think many white brothers and sisters under Obama were treated to that same kind of deference. Obama didn't challenge whiteness. Now, he couldn't afford to for the most part, but he went out of his way to challenge black people, which gave the lie and the false impression to the notion that black people had more cleaning up to do than white people, and black people had to come further in reaching across the aisle to white people than was conversely true. So when you put all that stuff together, I think that's the kind of stuff I'm trying to get at in terms of how whiteness operates historically.
You know, I saw you on Frontline last night as part of a two-part series they're doing on the Obama presidency, and you were one of many public intellectuals and reporters who were weighing in on that. And you talked about in an interview you did with the president in the Oval Office that he told you directly that he did not want to be the president for black people. And I wonder, I mean, and he had his reasons, whether or not you agree with them. I wonder, had he become the president for black people to a greater extent, would not that have perhaps animated even more obstreperousness and even more opposition from the right? I mean, how would that have changed the conversation?
Well, this is what I mean. See, we're already talking about an election under Donald Trump where the revenge of the white working class worked to assert the privilege of white people to finally get back in the conversation, right? So we don't mind saying that. But if we say, hey, he should be the president of black people, too, then, well, hey, because if he does that, then that's going to create problems. I don't mean I didn't want Barack Obama to be the president of black people. I wanted him to be the president of black people also. You see the difference? In other words, he's the president of everybody. He didn't say, I'm not the president of gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, queer people. Let me see. You turned the White House the rainbow colors when the Supreme Court announced its support for gay marriage. And he should have. He went out of his way to talk about environmentalists. In other words, there are many other groups that President Obama identified with. And I'm saying when he said to Black America, I am not the president of Black America, we wanted to have a no-crap Sherlock moment. I mean, we didn't think you were the head of the NAACP. You may not be the president of Black America, which is what the leading Black figure politically in America has usually had the title of, Martin Luther King Jr., Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton. But you are the president of Black Americans because we are citizens. So is the price of admission into the sweepstakes of the presidency for Black people the denial of political opportunity? Does it mean that we have to be quiet about the fact that our unemployment is twice that of white brothers and sisters? Does it mean we have to ignore the fact that Black kids are expelled from school far quicker and far easier than white brothers and sisters? Does it mean we have to deny the fact that police people target Black people with lethal intensity? In other words, what's the price of admission to having a Black president? And if it is the fact that we can't tell the truth about our suffering and to have our political interests protected, then it may be too high a price to pay.
The best part of your book to me, and the reason I think it is well worth the time for folks to read it, is that you're not addressing this book to bigots. And I wonder, I mean, can a bigot, in fact, be deprogrammed? I mean, at one point you say that what starts as shame, and everybody who has been part of the system that creates this litany of things you've just so beautifully adduced. But what starts as shame may end as transformation, but even that can't be depended on. So I wonder, what can be depended on? What works?
What you know. Well, what works is what you know in your heart, what you come to grips with, what the decision you make, the conclusions you draw at the end of a long process of critical self-reflection and telling the truth about how the world operates. If you can tell the truth then that's what we can depend on. You have come to an awareness that, hey, I've tried to dodge race. I've tried to dodge my responsibility. Look, I'm a man and a male supremacist inevitably in a world where gender operates, where women have been victimized. Now, that means I have to come to grips with all of the magical and mysterious ways in which patriarchy operates, the advantages I draw from being a man, the unconscious privilege I exercise as a result of that masculinity and my male privilege. I got to be honest about that. And it's difficult. Sometimes I'm defensive. No, that's not true. Yeah, maybe it is. And so I'm asking white brothers and sisters to think about telling the truth. At the end of the day, some white people come up to me and say, you know what, if we had to deal with what Black people had to deal with, I might not make it. Just be honest about that. You know it's not fair that Obama got treated the way he did, even though you can have legitimate differences with him that have to do with politics and ideology. At the end of the day, stop lying. You know that being called a witch doctor or his wife a simian or an ape, what does that have to do with your disagreements with them? And white America, stop being so willing to say, well, there was other things besides race, when you know how central racism is. When you know, when you are away from the cameras and the microphones that amplify the invidious bigotry that claims too much of the white American soul, you know the things your uncles and aunts say at Thanksgiving. You know the cantankerous bigotry that spews from their mouths. You know the politically incorrect, hateful things that are said by people who are otherwise decent human beings. So be honest about that and be honest about how that might make an impact upon how people do their jobs. You know some of these prosecutors who will never bring a policeman to account for what he has done, and that prosecutor is a bigot or unconsciously or sometimes consciously racist. You know Jeff Sessions acted like he was, you know, a schoolboy the other day when being interrogated. You know some of the stuff he said in terms of Black people, in terms of the N-word and being a boy and the vicious beliefs he has. You know that's wrong. And what you don't know is that when I appear on Fox like I did last night, or when I go on Twitter and some of my views are posted, white people call me nigger every day of my life, sir. I get death threats every day of my life, into the tens and twenties, to my public email at Georgetown. I could show them to you. This is a whiteness that refuses to surrender its thoroughgoing privilege, its hate of blackness, its animus, and it's not a small minority. Even if it may not be the overwhelming majority of white brothers and sisters, it claims a large enough of swath of white demography to make a huge difference in terms of how black people are viewed, how brown people are viewed, how red and yellow people are treated. And so let's be honest about this, white America. Stop telling lies. Or even more so, stop being innocent and ignorant of what you should know. You know, I teach at a Catholic school, Georgetown, and one of the things that they make, I think, tremendous use of is the notion of culpable ignorance. You know, the policeman stops you, you're going 50 miles in a 30-mile-hour zone. You go, oh, I didn't see that. I didn't know that. Well, when you took your driver's test, you were supposed to know that this shape of sign said that this is what the speed limit is and you should obey it. So in other words, you may be ignorant, but you're culpable. You're responsible for that ignorance. You should have learned that. And by now, white people, please grow up. Do we still have to repeat the mathematics, the basic fundamental arithmetic of social justice? We'll never get to the trigonometry of social transformation unless you are willing to admit that you missed the class on the arithmetic of social justice and you got to go back and study it, or you refuse to hear the lessons that were taught that day. That's the kind of thing that we have to be honest about.
Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, the new book is called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. And Dr. Dyson, I think there are a lot of people who do know, who do understand, who are horrified by Aunt Edna and Uncle Paul at Thanksgiving dinner. But knowing it and understanding it and being horrified is one part of it. The solution does, in fact, require much more than just understanding. And you write that black and white people are often speaking different languages with no common frame of reference and therefore no possibility of understanding each other. And that very well may be true, sir. So what is the next step after understanding and being horrified by it?
Then you got to reform yourself. You got, if you know, do. If you learn, apply. You know, I'm a teacher. And look, repetition is the critical tool of most teachers. You can't be up there like, oh, man, I said that already. Jesus, do I have to repeat it? Yeah, actually, you do.
Right.
And repeat it and repeat it. Write it and rewrite it. The greatest writer is a rewriter. The greatest speaker is one who says it again and again. You have to dress it up in a different way. You have to use different language, but you got to repeat it. So my point is that white brothers and sisters have to apply what they learn. And that's difficult. I know it is. I know I'm asking you something that is very difficult to do, but you've got to do it, because what's at stake is the future of this nation. What's at stake is the integrity of the soul of this nation. And what's at stake is the livelihood of millions of your fellow citizens. Do you want to be selfish and maintain the preserve of your privilege ad infinitum? Or do you want to begin to dismantle and deconstruct all of the advantages that you have unfairly accumulated? Because to be real, a lot of us live on stuff that we didn't earn. Many white brothers and sisters say, I wasn't here when slavery was going on. My parents weren't here. But you have benefited from white privilege, even if you came here 5 years ago. You might get a loan from a small business association or an administration in a way that people of color have been systematically denied. So you are the beneficiary of white privilege, even if you are not its origin.
I want to sneak in one phone call before we take a break. Ryan in Baltimore, you're on Midday with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson.
Hey, how are you? Listen, I can't get away from how utterly disgusted I am about some of the things that this doctor is saying. I respect all of your information. I respect the way that you're delivering it. You keep talking about, you know, blacks and white, black and white. I think more than anything, it seems to me, my father's a white guy from Pennsylvania. My mother is a black woman from Baltimore City. I'm married a Filipino girl from California. My brother is married to a girl in Japan. We are the antithesis of America. And the things you're saying about how, oh, he wasn't the president for blacks and whites, but that's part of the problem, the separation. You keep saying whiteness this, whiteness that. Where's the responsibility on the individual? All of this stuff that you're saying, it just comes back. You said it yourself. You know, you just delivered in a different way. What it sounds to me is you're delivering your own personal, whatever your own personal argument is about racism, you're delivering it in several different ways, only to say, I just don't like white people. It just sounds bonkers to me. I mean,
well, first
I have aunts and uncles.
I don't.
Just one second. I have aunts and uncles who have said words and things to me about right. my choice of my spouse, about my brother's right. choice of spouse, that are white people that still live in places that you wouldn't pay attention to, who voted right. for Trump, who insulted right. Barack Obama when we voted for him. But right. I mean, you're talking about all this responsibility on white people. I haven't once heard you say anything about when Jesse Jackson got caught on television talking stuff about Barack Obama, and it was the same difference. We can't get out of our own way. Everybody is screwing everybody up.
Well, Ryan, thank you for your call. By the way, Dr. Dyson does mention that very thing in the book.
Yes. Right. And I got 20 books, dog. I can't do it all in one book. You know what? One game can't exhaust LeBron James's career or Kobe Bryant's or Michael Jordan. You got to look at the arc of my career. I have dealt with everything you're talking about. And by the way, sir, there is no end to books being written about what responsibility of black people and brown people and what we got to do. And white folk love to talk about what responsibility black people do. So let me challenge you a bit, my brother, who called in. Is that what you're doing is rearticulating the very premise of whiteness. Whiteness, at the moment it gets challenged, well, how about you? It's a Pee Wee Herman response. I'm rubber, you're glue. Everything you say is bounces off to me and sticks to you. Come on, bruh. We have to have a little bit more depth than that. There has been the overwhelming majority, W.E.B. Du Bois said, people come to him and say, what does it feel like to be a problem? In other words, always problematizing and pathologizing, as V.Y. Mudimbi, the great Africanist, says, black culture, black urban existence, black people, that's always the normal move. What are you black people doing? What about black-on-black crime, black-on-black pathology, black-on-black family structures that are horrible? That ain't nothing new. You acting like you saying something that's out of the ordinary. What you are articulating is the very premise of the racial status quo. And to say, no, sir, I teach white people. I make money from teaching white people. I teach at Georgetown University. I love white people. I love white brothers and sisters, but I love them enough to tell them the truth. I love them enough to say what I believe. I don't think I have the only truth. But I think white people are not often told the truth in a mature estimation of the value of revelation and reflection. I don't think white people hear a lot of what black people actually have to say because they can protect themselves. They can go into their own cubbyholes. As Eric Holder said, we all do that. But I'm telling you, black people hear a lot more truth about race than white people do, and brown and red and yellow people do, than white people do. I do not hate white people, but what I hate is the inability to acknowledge that we have to come outside of our innocence and fragility and vulnerability and own up to what we have done.
We've got more with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson coming up about his book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. A bunch of folks on the phone waiting to talk to you, Dr. Dyson. We will get to as many of them as we can. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
The work of democracy has always been hard. It's always been contentious. Sometimes it's been bloody. For every two steps forward, it often feels we take one step back. But the long sweep of America has been defined by forward motion, a constant widening of our founding creed to embrace all and not just some.
President Barack Obama, during his farewell speech in Chicago last week, we're spending this week here on Midday discussing, among other things, the legacy of the nation's first African-American president. That discussion is inextricably tied to a conversation about race. My guest today has offered a provocative and important contribution to that conversation in his latest book. Dr. Michael Eric Dyson has written a challenging, raw, and passionate sermon to white America called Tears We Cannot Stop. Lots of folks on the phone, Dr. Dyson, I want to get to them. But first, let me ask you, because you do write about this in your book, have we taken during the Obama presidency two steps forward or one step back? Does the election of Mr. Trump indicate a step back? The president said earlier in that address that I've lived long enough to know that race relations are better than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. Do you agree?
Yes, sir. I think that there's no question that there's been enormous progress and evolution of opportunity for many people of color, and that there are things that are explicitly better than they were, and even dramatically so. But there's been a dramatic resurgence and recrudescence of a certain kind of animus toward blackness, a kind of revulsion at the basic level of the organism against the presence of blackness. And so we got to honor and brown and other minorities. And we got to be honest about that, too. And I think that constantly saying on the one hand that, hey, we've made racial progress in the face of enormous resurgence of racial animus is to do a disservice to the fact that, yes, that may be true, but it doesn't address why it's persistent. And the persistence of racial animus and the structural inequalities and inequities we have to deal with have to be addressed. So the rush to dismiss the legitimate acknowledgement of the problems is what is part of the issue as well. But then more broadly, you know, when we think about the fact that Obama's presidency has, you know, gone on for the last 8 years and what he's brought out and the enormous progress he's made, the presidency of Donald Trump represents a direct repudiation of so much of that progress as well. We have to be honest and engage that issue and talk about what he's brought to bear. The whitest administration since Ronald Reagan's, the undeniable and indisputable and unapologetic assertion of a certain kind of white male privilege as the predicate for doing politics in a city where he said he wanted to drain the swamp. He's put a bunch of billionaires and entrepreneurs and business people, some of whom have questionable dealings, into power, excuse me, with a man who has not revealed his taxes. We don't know his relationship to Russia and other places in the most, you know, lack of transparency of any presidency in the last half century.
Sure.
So this is a remarkable thing that we're enduring along with the other racial problems that have been revealed as a result of the Obama presidency. So Obama was a flashpoint and provoked some outrage that revealed the persistence of racial inequality. He didn't create it, but he certainly uncovered it.
Janet in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. And thank you, Tom, for having Dr. Dyson on. This is a tough subject. And Dr. Dyson, I want to thank you for doing this book, because not only does it present this, you know, the things you are articulating to white people, but it gives me, as a black woman, tools to use. A lot of my friends are white, and sometimes you want to find the right words to say to white people when they do things that just comes with their white privilege. They don't understand it. So just by listening, and I'm definitely getting your book, I think I have, I feel even more prepared to talk about that, because that's the only way we're going to move on in this country. So I'll take my comment from you or listen at, off the air. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Janet. Appreciate your call. Dr. Dyson, Michael writes from Baltimore, "I'm a white guy. Michael Eric Dyson is speaking so eloquently, I'm brought to tears. I already agree with his ideas of my responsibility and privilege, but his articulation is so forceful and profound that I can only say hallelujah. There are many of us white folks who feel this way and don't want to be innocent of these realities." So you do give folks a lot to think about. You also say, and I think this is a really interesting point, that you quote Dr. King when he mentioned that there's never been any single, solid, determined commitment on the part of a vast majority of white Americans to genuine equality for Negroes. That was his formulation back in the 60s. Do you think that's still the case? I mean, given the fact that the conversation about race, given the reality of a presidency of a Barack Obama, the conversation has certainly taken a different turn. Do you think that there is now, are we any closer to a determined commitment to genuine equality?
Unfortunately not. We've had tremendous progress. The election of Barack Obama himself has been an incredible opportunity for this nation to reflect upon the issue of race and to move beyond some of the perilous passages we've endured in the past. But the reality is the concerted effort that Dr. King made reference to has not been undertaken. We have not had a serious overhaul of the system in which we live to pay attention to the most vulnerable members of our society. And I know many white brothers and sisters say, wait a minute, we've paid all these billions of dollars in social welfare and the war on poverty, but we've spent even more, or at least a whole bunch, on the war against poor people through the drug war. We've locked them up. We've denied them economic and educational opportunity. Look at the fact that if you were born as a white person and the likelihood that one out of four of your men would go to prison or be in jail or be locked up or be somehow harassed by the prison industrial complex. You would not accept that. Imagine the number of white people who were to be harassed by the police and killed by them. So when we look across the board, no, I don't think we've made that concerted effort to really address the deep and profound malevolence that persists in this country around the issue of race. And I want to thank the caller who talked about being moved by my words. Those are precisely the millions of white folk out there who don't often have their voices amplified, who don't feel that they have the privilege to speak out against other more vociferous articulations of white bigotry. And I thank that caller for that. And there are millions more of white people out there that I want to at least give voice to or encouragement to as well.
And Linda, you're the next person to get voice. You are calling from Annapolis on Midday with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson. Let me tell you, Linda, we just have a few minutes left. So if you could make a succinct point, I'd be grateful.
Sure. Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I do see his points. I mean, I see it every day, and I understand that I am a result of white privilege. But what I don't know is just acknowledging these problems on the part of white people is not going to do anything. And it would be so nice if there was some way that we could be told what we need to do besides just saying that we acknowledge that we have white privilege and that racism does exist.
Thank you, Lyndon. Dr. Dyson, you have a long list of what folks can do.
Right, exactly. And I hate to sound self-promotional, but if you buy Tears, We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America, I have an entire chapter called The Benediction where I lay out some of the things that white brothers and sisters can do. Educate yourselves about the history of race. Be conversant with the long struggle and argument about how race operates in America. Become conversant with some of those writers, many of them white, who talk about the responsibility of white folk and how the privileges and blindnesses of whiteness operate. I talk about individual reparations account, which is controversial to some. I'm saying that since we can't just have an abracadabra magical transformation of the social structure where reparations are addressed, individual white brothers and sisters who are so inclined can do things on their own, provide a scholarship for a young person of color, treat somebody who cuts their lawn a bit better economically. Take those young neighborhood kids who you think are maybe problematic or in somebody else's neighborhood who are black or brown and treat them to a day at the museum or a movie that they wouldn't ordinarily see in a neighborhood that is safe. So there are many individual things that white brothers and sisters can do to address this situation along with strategic social action in behalf of racial justice.
Dr. Dyson, we just have a few seconds left here, but I do want you to comment real briefly on something right in the addendum to the book that you wrote after the election. Evidently, most of the rest of the book was written before the election. You say the mistake we make is to believe that whiteness is only prejudice, that it's only bigotry, that it's only the cry of hate. That's only partly true. In 15 seconds, sir, what's the other part?
The other part is the refusal to acknowledge white innocence, white privilege, white vulnerability. And it is to say that black people and brown and red and yellow people, too, want the same things you want. And as a result of that, when you want to know what to do, ask yourself what would be good for you to exist in and with. And that would help go a long way toward answering and relieving the burden we experience.
Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, his latest book is a terrific read. I can't recommend it highly enough. Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. He's also the author of 19 other books, including The Black Presidency, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Race in America. We'll have links and more information on our website, WIPR.org/midday. Dr. Dyson, thank you so much for the book and for your time this afternoon. I really appreciate it.
My friend, for your excellent conversation, I'm grateful.
Me too. Coming up tomorrow, the last in our series of conversations examining President Obama's 8 years in the White House. What did the president do, and what has he left undone in areas like health care, criminal justice, the economy, and foreign policy? Liz Copeland is the founder of the Urban Conservative Project, and journalist Michael Days is the author of a new book that examines President Obama's accomplishments. They'll join me on Midday tomorrow, and then on Friday, we'll bring you NPR's live special coverage of President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.